Recordings have started.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the IGO-INGO Access to Curative Rights Protection Mechanism Working Group call on the 15th of June, 2017. On the call today, we have George Kiriopis, David Maher, Jay Chapman, Paul Tattersfield, Petter Renforth, and Phil Corwin. We have a listed apology from Mason Cole. From staff, we have Barry Cobb, Mary Wong, Steve Chan, and myself, Terry Agnew. I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to our co-chair, Petter Renforth. Please begin.
Thank you, Petter here. First question, of course, any new statement of interest? See no hands up. And seeing here the proposed agenda, as you have all seen, we have got from the staff an updated pros and cons document regarding options 1 and 2 for the preliminary recommendation number 4. And we have also got a limited sampling of data of the main registrations relating to the IGOs currently on the GAC list of 2013. So if we start with going through the I'll see if I can just make a little bit bigger on my screen. I'll start with the reviewing of the pros and cons. You all know the text of the recommendation number 4. And I scroll it down to I can go quickly through the summary, but what I think it's interesting to see and evaluate then is the impact analysis of option 1 and 2. We have discussed this initial part several times, but the benefits of option 1 that preserves the rights of registrants respondents to fundamental rights of access to national courts. Disadvantages are not consistent with the request from GAC and the IGOs. The benefits, also court decides case on the novel basis. It's not strictly speaking an appeal from panel determination. Disadvantages, what would be the advantages of vitiating the initial panel determination in such case? We have seen that. I'm scrolling here. I hope that you're not seeing the same.
Hi, Petter. This is Steve. Yeah. I was wondering if I might be able to jump in for a second.
Yep.
Sorry, I had my hand up.
Sorry.
Thanks. This is Steve Chan from staff, and before we get into the details of the document, the staff wanted to provide a little bit of context and high-level understanding of what has changed in this document since the last time the working group has reviewed it.
Oh, yes, that would be very good. Thanks.
Sure. Thank you very much. So what you'll see is that staff has added a limited set of assumptions for the working group to consider as they review this document. As you move into the benefits and disadvantages, we've incorporated the the suggested changes from the working group members, as well as what has been discussed in the previous working group calls. We've also integrated or added in a new column for working group discussions and comments. That's been added on the far right in the table for each of the options. Also, again, to incorporate discussions from previous calls. And then so the new thing that we've added that we talked about conceptually is the impact analysis. So you'll now see an actual example of what that looks like here. Some of the issues have been suggested here. It's not intended to be exhausted, but more illustrative. And so that relates to the impact analysis of the recommendations. One of the things that's suggested under the GNSS procedures and is intended to better assess the working group's recommendations. And so at the very end of this document, just to take one step back, there's an impact analysis for each of the two options. And then finally, just wanted to say that the last thing is we've put in an explanation for the foundation of the impact analysis framework that we suggested as staff. This is one example of a methodology to do the impact analysis. The working group is, of course, free to utilize a different model if it so pleases, but here's one example that you, as a working group, could consider as an option. So I think that's the high level we want to add. Barry, Mary, if you want to add anything, please go for it. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve. Did Mary add something to add? No? Okay. So then I'd rather, because we have seen the benefits and disadvantages before, I don't think we have so much new there. So I'll concentrate on the right column with the discussion comments. That is good summarizing there. So when we talked about the benefits and disadvantages here, mitigating the UDRP decision only takes place if the IGO successfully asserts immunity, thereby terminating the lawsuit. And mitigating the UDRP decision thus maintains the status quo of the if the UDRP has never been filed. The IGO can then decide whether to pursue other kinds of actions, voluntary arbitration, mediation, or intervention by national authorities. And we also have a comment that says that, the second sentence doesn't make sense. Filing the lawsuit preserved the status quo register lock hold with the registrar and kept the registrant the same, meaning that of the original domain name registrant who was the respondent of the UDRP and complainant in the lawsuit, nothing happens until the lawsuit is concluded and any all available appeals. And there's a note from the staff, written a second sentence, amended and rephrased. Okay, thanks. Then we have the next comment on that the creates certainty for losing registrant in terms of the consequences of filing a complaint in national court. The negatives are, what are the implications of saying that the court complaint upholding an IGO's immunity claim automatically means an otherwise legally valid panel determination is not void, has no legal effect. And the comments here we have summarized, the mere filing a court complaint doesn't do anything. IGO has to make a decision as to whether to assert immunity and await the court's determination as to whether to accept that defense to the court action. Registrars must wait until the court has made a final determination. It is only the court can order a transfer of the domain name. And a note from the staff or in the text rephrased to clarify that it is not the filing but the determination by the court that triggers irradiation. And as we have discussed before also, and we know that at this stage, the court will make the decisions, and it could be a clear case where a thing is handled by the court, or it could stop there at the first initial phase, and thereby the original decision by the panel will stand. Mary, your hands up.
Yes, and thank you, Peter. So, first of all, you know, apologies if our initial language was misleading or inaccurate. Hopefully, the updates that we've made in response to George's and others' comments make it much clearer now. But secondly, I guess more substantively, I think what we were trying to say from the staff side is whether or not there are potential legal issues that may be created by the fact that in a court proceeding, not on the substance or the merits, but basically on whether or not an IGO can claim jurisdictional immunity, that based on that, non-substantive on the merits type of proceeding and finding, that we are able to say automatically that an initial panel determination is now void and has no legal effect. And we raise this because we are not experts in this kind of procedure, but we just thought it's something that the working group might like to note and, if necessary, get some advice on. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. Phil?
Yeah, thank you. Phil, for the record. As we discuss option one and option two, given the fact that this working group's been at this for quite a long time, I believe we're at 3 years now, but I know we've been going quite a while on this. And we'd like to see something concrete result from our work, because our work is the first step in a process, and whatever we finally report out will go to council for its review and hopefully its approval. We're all aware of that the original request of the IGOs was for a process that did not find support in this working group, which was for a totally separate DRP, not related to the UDRP, which it wasn't clear from their ask, but it seemed like it would be based both on trademark law rights and other rights stemming from their claim special status, which would could lead to broader rights than complainants in a UDRP. So in that context and in anticipation of questions or objections to either of these options, I think we just should openly explore them. And in that context, I want to raise two issues that concern me and I've pursued to some extent. The first is we haven't changed an option one in no way would change the current UDRP. Option two would change it slightly for a very narrow circumstance that may or may not ever occur. But option one would say that if the IGO successfully asserts an immunity defense in a courtroom, and as we know from Professor Swain, the things that are in our report and in option one are nothing new. An IGO today could file through an agent, assignee, or licensee. They don't need our empowerment to do that. We're simply noting that they have that possibility to take that path if they wish to further insulate their claim of jurisdictional immunity. And under Professor Swain's memo, if an IGO brought a UDRP today and if the domain registrant lost and decided to file a judicial appeal, the IGO today would be free to assert immunity, and per Professor Swain's memo, they might succeed in that argument, notwithstanding the mutual jurisdiction clause, or the argument might fail. In my own mind, you know, if immunity is a defense, it would be whether they had waived that defense by agreeing to mutual jurisdiction. So that leads to, I've engaged with a number of UDRP panelists and other attorneys who know this field and said, if today an IGO successfully asserted immunity, if there was a judicial appeal from a UDRP decision, and if the court granted that immunity, what would happen with the underlying UDRP decision? And a number of them have said, well, it would be reinstated and the domain would be transferred. So I don't know what the answer is, but I think if that's a possibility, we'd be changing that outcome with option one. The other concern I think will come up with option one is that our whole approach up to now has been to say we're not going to have ICANN grant IGOs immunity in advance of judicial determination. If that situation ever arises, it's up to the judge. But the import of option one is essentially to tell the IGO, well, you're free to assert your immunity, but if you're successful in that claim, the cyber squatting that would found by the panel, you know, now the panel could be wrong, but in many cases they're right in the finding of cyber squatting, will be permitted to continue. So I'd like a little more discussion on those two points of what would happen if our working group didn't exist and a scenario arose today where IGO brought a UDRP registrant appealed under a national law, IGO successfully asserted immunity, what would happen today to the underlying UDRP decision, and is option one consistent with our kind of hands-off approach where we're saying we're not going to have ICANN interfere with any determination on the immunity issue. We're going to leave that to judges in national courts. So I'll stop there. I hope that's helpful and leads to some beneficial discussion. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil. And as Paul also correctly is noted in the chat, if there is no court action, domain is transferred, because that's the decision that is made, and there's a limited time where the losing party can take the case to a court be handled there. But there is only a very limited time to act, and if nothing happens within that time, the original decision will be the one that is a legal issue. So transfer or whatever the decision was. Mary, please.
Thanks, Petter, and I think you did say some of what I wanted to follow up with based on Phil's comments, and thanks for setting it out so clearly, Phil. I think that really is the nub of it, that at the moment, if a registrant or anyone were to take the matter to a national court after there has been an initial panel determination, that panel determination isn't necessarily vitiated in any way. It basically is what it is until the court rules one way or the other. And as we know, I guess the court does do it de novo, but the court could rule that the initial determination stands, or it could rule that the initial determination was wrong and therefore the contrary remedy applies. So our concern here, and again, I emphasize that none of us on the staff are experts on this kind of procedural question. By saying in option one that there is a vitiation, we are concerned that that creates some kind of legal implication or consequence that we may need to consider further. Quite aside from the fact or the question that Paul has raised as to whether or not we do need to make an additional change to the UDRP as a result if we were to go with option one. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Maryam. As we are now in this discussion, I plan to make this example at the end of it, but I threw it out now just to explain how I see it. Let's say that there is someone, not me, but let's say that there's someone that had the fantastic idea to start a website where you could easily find all kinds of goods from different countries in the world, and it's simply called the World Website. And then in social media, it's highly appreciated, and someone saying the world is perfectly organized. And then the person who owned the World Website thought that, okay, that's a good slogan. However, the world is perfectly organized. It's a little bit too long to register as a domain name, so we registered the short version, WIPO. And as it's dealing with shops, I use, let's say, a new top level to buy. So WIPO to buy. And for a while, it's a parking site because the person needed some more time to create the website. And then WIPO is taking the case to a UDRP case. And I would say that it's probably likely that the domain holder would lose that case. And let's say I've seen a lot of comments from a U.S.-based legal view on when it comes to arbitration and court cases. So let's say that this is in Europe and the case is taken to a Swedish court, and WIPO claimed immunity and the court just noted that they can't take the case. So option one for the domain holder, the case ends there and he loses. Or option two, the possibility to take it to a three-member panel of neutrals and have it decided there in an arbitration. And as Paul said, this UDRB case may even be handled by WIPO. So, I don't know if we have discussed that in detail yet, but I mean, in a normal arbitration case, in civil disputes, each party can choose a member of the three-member panel, even if it's the panel are neutrals. They can choose a person that understand their specific issue. So each party have that possibility, which is the same when it comes to a three-member panel in the UDRP dispute. And then either cooperate in choosing the chair or the organization offering the dispute procedure will choose one from their list. And I would say that, as I see it, in a case like that, of course, the decision, the arbitration decision can be in favor of the domain holder or in the complainant, but still the case will be dealt with fully out, and also the domain holder has a possibility to actually take one panelist from the list that they think can better understand their situation and their use and the creation of the domain name. So that's one example I've just thought about that also shows that also the domain holders actually have benefits of option two. Okay. If we proceed with the analysis, I think we were on the the name, the same UDRP US process applies all the way through. Yes, Paul, thank you.
Can you hear me better?
Yes.
Better?
I hear you.
Can you hear me? Okay, good. Yeah. Well, please let me know. I understand everything about option one that's here. I don't know if everybody wants to continue going through it line by line. But otherwise, we could skip to the conversation of option two, which would kind of get us moving forward. If we would like, yeah, I'm sorry, this is Paul Keating speaking. Sorry, Terry. there are a lot of issues to deal with if we're going to consider option two, which is the arbitration provision, and they go well beyond the general comments that you raised. So if we're there, please let me know. I'd like to make some comments to address those issues. If not, I'll just go back and mute my microphone and listen until we get to that point.
Thanks, Paul. I think it's a good idea if we can perhaps more quickly go to the impact analysis of option one and two, and then step it further to discuss option two. But I'll leave it, see if there are any hands up to further analyze the comments we have on each option. See no hands up? Thanks. Then I just, Paul. Yes. Paul?
Can you hear me now?
Now I can hear you,
this
yes.
This is Paul Keating, for the record. If we're now discussing the pros and cons of option two, I think we ought to discuss those in depth. Some of the issues that present themselves is, in addition to, who obviously is the arbitration provider? Right? What language is the arbitration going to be in? Are there going to be, where is the arbitration going to be deemed to take place for the purposes of oral testimony, which all arbitration provisions provide for? To what substantive law is going to be applied by the arbitrators? Those are all issues I didn't see them in any of the pros and cons discussion for option two, and those need to clearly be described. And in my opinion, if we're going to suggest that option two exists and should be given any credible thought, then we have an obligation to present what the constraints of that option should be and why those constraints have been adopted as a recommendation by the working group.
Thanks, Paul. And before I reply to that, I see Phil's hands up, so please.
Yeah, Phil, for the record. Paul, thank you for raising those issues, though I think you're getting a little bit ahead of where we are in today. Call. I didn't note you're raising those elements in an email on the list recently, and there's an effort going on by Petter and myself with staff to prepare a paper for review by the entire review and discussion by the entire working group of what the. Because beyond considering the high-level pros and cons of option one and option two, which is what we're trying to wrap up today, any further consideration of option two would need to get into the weeds. It wouldn't have to be a full implementation review, but it would certainly have to set what the policy should be for an option two of the key elements that you've identified. So there's work going on by the co-chairs to develop a proposal, the intent of which is to keep a post-UDRP arbitration, again, in the very rare circumstance where the registrant appeals from the UDRP and the IGO successfully asserts immunity in the judicial forum, which we don't know if that will ever happen, but option one or two are all about what would happen in that probably rare circumstance. And the intent of the outline we're working on is to be to keep the arbitration that would occur under option two upon successful assertion of immunity in all of its elements as close as really as possible to what a judicial proceeding would have been under the national law in which the arbitration, on which the appeal, for the de novo appeal was brought. So that effort is ongoing, but we don't have that document ready for working group review and discussion yet. We have just shared that with staff for their comments, and our intent would be after today's meeting to share that with the entire working group and possibly to discuss this at our next meeting, which would be the face-to-face meeting taking place in Johannesburg in 2 weeks. So to sum up the elements, the need to be very specific about what the elements of an arbitration procedure under option two is a very important point. I thank you for raising it, but I think we're probably at least a meeting away from having a straw man document to discuss, to flesh out those concepts. Okay? Thank you.
Thanks. And I see also some comments from George that well, point up some of the issues that we are considering when it comes to that draft way of option two. And one, of course, question is also to identify the provider in a clear way. Okay, Paul?
Thank you. Paul Keating again, for the record. Phil, that's fine, but I just want to be clear that for me to support the final report, if option two is going to be suggested directly or indirectly, then I would insist that there be actually procedural rules that are set forth and explained as to why those are. I know that's a big ask, but if we don't do it that way, then I think we're just leaving this whole Pandora's box open for someone else to come in and just create whatever rules they want. And all of our work has been for naught. The other point raised is that there have been a couple of people that I've been reviewing this matter with, and the idea came up for an option three. Okay? And an option three is basically let it go to the judicial authority, but obligate the respondent to waive any monetary claims that they may otherwise have against the NGO. It seems to me that the only issue here is who gets to keep the domain name. I don't think that the NGOs are concerned about a decision that is limited to that extent. What they're afraid of is some sort of monetary damage that is assessed against them. So I think that option three should also be considered. It's also benefits of being an extremely streamlined approach to things. If you keep everything the way it is, you just simply have the respondents waive the right to receive any other remedy other than the retention of the domain name. Okay? Most potential respondents that I know of that I've discussed this with are in favor of this, because they know that they're never going to recover any damage judgment anyway. And that's not what they're in there for. They're in there to recover and keep the domain name. So I think that would satisfy the concerns of the respondents on that side. From the NGO standpoint, I would fully expect that notwithstanding are going all the way through option two, they are still going to insist that the remedies available be limited to the issue of the domain name possession and that the arbitrators be prohibited from granting any award, monetary award or other form of remedy. So if we're going to go all the way through the production of creating a separate arbitration system, which essentially gives that same remedy, that remedy is easily obtained just by requiring a waiver from the respondent. So that's what I would like also to be considered, okay? I propose this, often, early and often, and I'd like to have it re-raised because it seems like we're going down the same pathway and we're going to get to the same conclusion eventually. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Peter here. If I understand you correctly, what the base of your suggestion is that the remedies are the same as in a traditional UBRP dispute, so that the losing party does not have to pay any remedies. Yeah, thanks. And I see no, we'll have to discuss it, but I mean, there should still be possibilities actually to consider that when it comes to option two, to find a way that is decent and convenient and safe for both parties. And yours is what Paul was saying, though, was keep it short. But still, the problem here is if the court will not take the case. Paul?
Well, Peter, if the court doesn't take the case and dismisses it because there's no cause of action recognized, for example, then the respondent's just out of luck. That's the way things work now. So I'm not changing anything there. What I'm saying is, it seems to me from everything that I've heard and read about the NGO's concerns here, they are concerned about a remedy which extends beyond mere possession and control of the domain name. Right? They don't want to be on the receiving end of a judgment that has anything to do with other than, that grants any remedy other than possession of the domain name. That's fine. The respondent can waive that. We can require that the respondent waive that as a condition to proceeding against the NGO. And therefore, you don't need this complex arbitration process. So it's not quite a part of option two. It's actually, it's between option one and option two. It's a separate option, but it's very simple.
Okay, thanks. George
Kirikos for the transcript. Yeah, because I think one of the things that the IGOs raised in one of the meetings, and perhaps on their own separate IGO mailing list, is that, for example, a disgruntled employee might create an anti-IGO website, and then if the IGO was to proceed, and that employment issue could only perhaps be solved by binding arbitration. But if the IGO created a UDRP against that employee's domain name or former employee's domain name, then the waiver of immunity in the UDRP might mean that the employee could then go to court and then challenge the IGO not just on the domain name dispute, but also raise the issue of the employment dispute. So I think that's what Paul's proposal helps to ameliorate, and it also ameliorates the concern of the IGOs in that regard. So I think that's a very big win-win if that approach is incorporated into the option number one. Thanks.
Thanks. And you said one specific word here that is the problem with option one, may. I think what we want to create is a system that giving it clear to both parties involved that the case will actually be considered and dealt with to have a final decision. That is also in a neutral way, but still also can be accepted by IGOs as not dealt with by a national court, but also can be accepted and actually workable for the main holder. That could well be physical, person, or a small company that deals with, they have registered the domain name in good faith and have this dispute and actually want to have their legal case to be considered in a decent way. So, okay. And George says, Phil, I'd be saying that the scope of the UDRP waiver is only with respect to the domain name aspect. If someone wanted to raise the damage issue, the IGO could properly assert immunity. They would argue that they didn't waive that issue for immunity. Well, we'll see about that. I just wanted to think quickly also that, so that we have actually discussed or analyzed the impact analysis for both options, so that we have done that today. As you can see here for option one, mediating the decision does not improve access for IGOs to the UDRP and URS. We have talked about the IGOs may be able to use an SNE and licensee. My comment on that is that it's that possibility, but from the comments we have got both officially and when we met IGO representatives in the ICANN meetings, they state that they see a problem to use an SNE or licensee for their specific names, and they also somehow also said that it's not the way that they normally deal with these kind of cases. They want to be forced to use that way to have a dispute being solved. I know that we initially at least we discussed if there were other kind of business disputes where this was actually used, but when it comes to the main disputes, this is the comments we have got. And also IGO must assert its jurisdictional immunity in national courts, possibly establishing a precedent for waiving immunity. And they have on the mitigation side, IGOs can selectively waive immunity in certain circumstances. Yes, so that's the possibility. I mean, there could be actually some IGOs that will perfectly accept to have the case taken to a final decision in the national court, and which would be good for both parties involved, but we see that there is a risk that they will refer to the immunity and the court, which is also not clear if how the court will deal with that. We saw that from the Swain's report, but in some courts they will accept the immunity, and that's the end of the dispute, so to speak. That's also why I think option two, and specifically in the version that Phil and I and stuff are working on, with option two taking in some of the aspects also of option one, could be a decent solution for this topic to be solved by and acceptable by both parties. And then issue 3 may establish precedent of UDRP-URS decisions being vitiated without the court decision on the merits of the case, relying on finding of jurisdiction immunity, that's what we talked about, could make carve-out provisions here narrow in the scope and very specifically target. And then point 4, we have no notes on that. Vitiating the decision may encourage losing respondents to challenge the decision. I will not go through all the discussion comments on option 2. So I go over to the impact analysis of option 2, but I'll give the word to George first.
George Kruger, just for the transcript. I just wanted to make a comment on issue number 4, where there was no real discussion.
Yep.
I think number 4, the likelihood that somebody would, you know, knowingly file a frivolous lawsuit, you know, is a very low probability. You know, where the lawsuits will tend to be filed is, you know, when there's a very high-value domain name that's under dispute, and, you know, the person, the decision isn't correct, and the respondent, you know, feels that to get justice, their only recourse is to the courts because there are no other options. And so to say that, you know, that it encourages them to challenge the decision, hoping that, you know, the IGO is going to make this immunity argument isn't necessarily, you know, a carrot. You know, the respondents or the domain name owner will have to spend a lot of money to go to court. And there are, you know, in most jurisdictions, there would be, you know, very serious penalties, monetary penalties for filing a frivolous lawsuit as well. So those would mitigate the idea that's, you know, going to be a strategy for domain name registrants. Thanks.
Thanks, George. Phil?
Thanks, Phil, for the record. In regard to the impact analysis for option 2, I think issue 1 is just incorrect. Option 2, in any, you know, we haven't discussed what elements might be, does not deny registrants access to national courts. What we're talking about with option 1 and option 2 would be, and again, this could happen today. We're not creating a new opportunity for this to happen. IGO brings UDRP. IGO wins UDRP. Domain registrant appeals. IGO asserts immunity, which it could do today. We all know that. We're not creating some new right to assert immunity that doesn't exist now. And the judge in the national court grants immunity to the IGO. Both option 1 and 2 are about what happens after that granting of immunity. When the judge finds that IGO defense is valid. So there's no denial of access to national courts under either option. They're both about what happens after a sitting judge in a national court grants an immunity defense. So I that's just incorrect. We should be clear on that for both options. So far as special precedent, I wouldn't know. This working group has broad leeway to define what the impact of our final report should be, whatever it is. And I note that in the comment of the business constituency on our initial report, a comment in which I had some input, that while they support option 2 over option 1, they're quite clear in their official comment that they do not that this they view this as a very narrow circumstance that should not create any precedent for any entity other than an IGO to have some kind of special treatment, whether it's option 1 or option 2. In the case of an immunity defense, and I think our final report can be just as specific and final about limiting any precedential value of whatever we recommend in the end. So far as inconsistent with UDRP URS, both options are, as we've discussed, you know, option one appears to be a variation of what would happen under current UDRP practice if a court case was thrown out for whatever reason, including acceptance of an immunity defense. Under current practice, the consensus view seems to be that the UDRP decision would be reinstated and the domain would be transferred to the IGO. So whether we're talking about that not happening, about vitiating the UDRP decision, which is option one, or about going to an arbitration, which is option two, both of them are different than current practice. There's no difference in that regard. It's just what the difference is going to be. My last statement on that point is that if the consensus view of the UDRP expert attorneys I've consulted with is correct, that the decision would be reinstated, then option two actually would provide some benefit for a domain registrant that is not available today, whereas today if a IGO asserted immunity and the court case was terminated based on that defense, the registrant would not have an opportunity for a de novo hearing, and option two would provide that opportunity, which, if the analysis is correct, does not exist today. Issue four about agreement of the respondent to the adjusted terms, we'll need to look at that. I agree that's something we shouldn't pass over lightly. And the final issue I want to raise that's not addressed here is what IGOs are we talking about? As we know from our comments received on the initial report, at least some commenters, including the government of the United States, are concerned that some organizations that assert to being IGOs are not, in fact, real, quote-unquote, IGOs. So I don't know if we should try to define who's an IGO that gets option one or option two treatment or option three treatment, whatever we come out with, or whether we should just leave that to the judge if there's an immunity defense raised and where the litigant domain registrant could say, you can't assert that immunity defense because you're not a real IGO. I'm not sure who should make that decision of which what IGOs are authentic and which are inauthentic, but I think it's one more thing we need to check the box on before wrapping up our work. So I'm going to stop there and get out of the way, and I see Mr. Keating has his hand up. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil. Peter here. Just a quick comment on the identification of IGOs. We have our own, as you know, we have identified our own way to see the legal protection of an IGO. But as you also know, when it comes to the clearinghouse and other aspects, we have the GAC list of IGOs that is created in another way with not the same identification as we have. So I think that was a good note that we also have to be clear on how, at least some kind of recommendation on how to identify the complainant as an IGO. And perhaps that will be dealt with already on the first base in the URS or the UDRP case, because that will be the first part when the complainant, the IGO, raise the its issue and identify its rights. I see your hands up, Paul, but I also see that Mary's hands up, so I'll give it first to Mary.
Thanks, Peter. And actually, my hand went up to follow up on one thing that Phil noted about when option one or two might kick in. And in that regard, for folks who are not in Adobe or not following the Adobe chat, there's also a comment that Paul Tattersfield put into the Adobe chat on a similar line to what I'm about to say. And it is that as the recommendation currently stands, recommendation four, before we even get to option one or option two, the IGO does have to successfully plead immunity in national court. And in that regard, we recall that Professor Swain in his memo had noted a couple of things. One, obviously, is that the law on the waiver of immunities by IGOs is not very well developed. But in that regard, he had also noted that granting mutual jurisdiction, such as by initiating a complaint, would likely be understood as a waiver of immunity. So we're not raising that as something to say we should not consider option one or option two, but to the extent that we're looking at our recommendations as a whole, if the working group were to go down a path of, say, arbitration under option two, it may be worth reviewing or recollecting this particular part of Professor Swain's advice as well. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Mary. And sorry, Paul, just two sentences about that. As I see it, or another way to see it, in fact, is that option one is will be the first step in each case. But if the immunity is successfully claimed, then in option two, the case is not closed there. So then it will be option two with the arbitration part. So frankly, they are not so on a collision course, option one and option two. As I see it, option two is more of the next step, so to speak, if the court says no. Yes, Paul.
Everybody's use of option numbers. So I just want to I want to describe what I think the process is that we're talking about. The procedure is first the respondent loses the UDRP, then they file a legal action in a court of mutual jurisdiction, then the IGO has the option to come in and contest the jurisdiction of the court based upon sovereign immunity. That leaves the respondent available to counter that argument however that respondent wishes to do so, and it leaves it to the court to make the determination, is this defendant an IGO, and is it entitled to sovereign immunity? If the answer to that question is it's whatever it is, it's not entitled to sovereign immunity, then the court proceeds, right? And we're not discussing any options. The court proceeds, issues its judgment, and be done with it. If the IGO is successful in that the court says, yes, you're an IGO, yes, you're entitled to sovereign immunity, then we're talking about one of these options. Either option one, the UDRP is vitiated, and the matter stops, because the respondent doesn't have to do anything further, okay? Option two is then, on that case, the respondent is obligated to pursue the matter in arbitration, or one of the parties is, and we have to decide who the party is, who's going to be the claimant in the arbitration process, right? So that's the procedural posture of what we're talking about. That's what I want to clarify. That's my understanding of the procedural posture. Okay, so we never get to option one or two decision until the judge makes a decision about whether or not sovereign immunity exists. Okay, Just asking for clarity on that point.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. That's correct. So, if I rephrase what I said, option one is a no in the first step is a no. Option two gives the complainant that is likely to be the main holder a possibility to actually have the case considered by neutral panelists. And although I saw some of the chat communication and email information about what some people are thinking about that kind of panelists in arbitration courts, my experience is that it's actually a very good way to deal with a dispute that for once may not all parties may not want to have everything information official, and that also depends on the country and the legislation there, how much that it's possible to be public in a civil court action. But meaning in an arbitration, we can be sure that the parties are dealing with a dispute between themselves and the panelists, and also the possibility actually to choose one panelist that you think have experience and could better understand your specific legal issue and your specific business to better solve the case, still in a neutral way, of course. Paul.
Oh, sorry, I didn't realize my hand was still up.
So then it was George's hand, I thought.
George Krikos here. Yeah, and there are problem with option number two is that the IGO and the domain owner have no contractual relationship. So the idea is that, you know, what's going to bind the IGO to even accept arbitration? They could say, you know, we're complete strangers. What claim do you have against us? You know, normally when the arbitration option exists, IGOs and the other party have some form of contract, and it's specified in that contract that, you know, in the event of a dispute, you know, we agree to this arbitration. That's like very explicit. IGOs could simply turn around in this case and say we have no contractual relationship because obviously even under the EDRP, the domain owner and the IGO have no contractual relationship. It's the contract between the registrar and the domain owner that are advantage of. So there's, you know, a big possibility that the IGOs could turn around and say, you know, who is this guy? You know, he has no relationship to us. There should be no arbitration. It's kind of saying that either the RAA, you know, the registrant agreement would have to be changed, or the fact of even responding to a UDRP would require that the registrant agrees to that, or it would have to be in the UDRP. You know, what happens if the registrant doesn't even let the UDRP panel decide? You know, he goes to court, he or she goes to court immediately and seeks a court ruling. You know, what happens in that scenario? So I think, you know, it's not clear that, you know, these options are necessarily capturing all the possibilities. Thanks.
Thank you, George. And it's a good point that we need to solve in the final document to make sure that IGOs also find that binding of option two. What makes that luckily to be accepted by IGOs is that kind of system, if they does not get a completely separate dispute resolution procedure, which was their first option, it seems that that is something that they can accept. So I presume that we can, if we reformulate one of the topics in that regulations or recommendations, we have to find a way to make it clear that an IGO that starts or getting involved in a business from the beginning also accept that as the final step if the court doesn't take the case. Paul.
Thank you. This is Paul Keating for the record. George, great point. I had not thought of a preemptive litigation matter in this context, but the post-UDRP litigation context can be resolved contractually if we put into the, I don't want to write a paragraph or 5 pages of it, of an arbitration proceeding and rules to be appended to the RA agreement. That's going to, I think the RA agreement is already exceeding 20 pages. I don't think it should be any longer. So what we could deal with is we could say that if the UDRP is presented and the decision is that the domain transfers to the complainant, the IGO, the respondent still remains available, it has its available remedies going to court. If the IGO asserts immunity, then the IGO has an obligation following that assertion. It's the IGO that must go to then file the arbitration claim in the designated arbitration location. And it must do so within a fairly short time frame, because we have to remember that this domain name is still locked up. Okay? If the IGO does not commence the arbitration proceeding within the specified time limit, then the UDRP is vitiated, and the domain name stays with the respondent. So I think that's a fair balance, because it places the obligation on the IGO to initiate the arbitration, if it so desires. If it doesn't, then it's going to have wasted its UDRP efforts. And that way, George, I think you can get at least the post-UDRP decision in a contractual manner so that everything will stick. Now, as to the pre-UDRP decision, a preemptive litigation matter by the respondent, I don't think that there's any way that we can control that, because that preemptive litigation strategy would exist from the moment that the IGO sent me a cease and desist letter. I could, on the basis of that cease and desist letter, immediately initiate litigation. I don't have to wait for a UDRP. And then, in the context of that litigation, wherever I happen to file it, wherever the jurisdiction was proper, that court would have to determine whether or not the IGO was an IGO, and if so, whether they had immunity. I don't think we can address that issue at all, Jordan. There's just no legal foundation upon which to build that house.
Thanks, Paul. Phil?
Yeah, Phil, for the record. Two quick comments. On the preemptive litigation strategy, I'm not sure, and I'm hoping that we don't have to address that. I don't see that as our charter mandate. To me, that's we're dealing with... We were asked under our charter to determine whether or not IGOs had effective access to effective dispute resolution procedures, curative rights process, whatever, and we've basically decided that they do, based on their trademark rights, whether they're registered or whether they're common law, as evidenced by Article 6 tier filing with WIPO. So we haven't changed that. We're dealing now with what happens if there's a final decision in a UDRP and the registrant, the losing domain registrant, files a judicial appeal to a court of mutual jurisdiction and there's immunity defense raised. I'm not really sure that it's our responsibility or even within our charter to address the preemptive situation, and I don't know that ICANN has any authority where it's not based on a UDRP final decision to say anything to the national court that gets that preemptive suit or why that national court would even be interested. What we're really talking about is what happens with the UDRP process if there's a successful assertion of immunity. Option one, which we've discussed, may be a change from current practice, would say, well, that underlying UDRP decision against the domain registrant is vitiated as if it never happened, and the domain continues to be in possession of the registrant. And we've discussed that might not receive the best reception within certain quarters of ICANN that are going to review our final report. Option two says, hey, in that case, the domain remains frozen, and the registrant gets an arbitration appeal, and as we'll discuss when we get to elements, an arbitration appeal based on the national law under which the appeal was brought, the de novo appeal. So, again, I just don't see that it's our right or responsibility to speak to the preemptive. So far as the mutual jurisdiction clause, we've determined so far not to touch that because to exempt IGOs from that clause would basically be to say that there'd be no court hearing because they hadn't agreed to be in court. It would be granting, in a way, it's granting their immunity up front, which we determined we weren't going to do. If it in an option two scenario or any other option, if the IGO asserts immunity, it's going to be up to the judge as to whether they've waived that immunity, and they can make they can certainly argue to the judge, well, here we are, judge, we're acting consistent with that mutual jurisdiction, but when we agreed to that, we didn't agree to waive all our defenses, and immunity is defense. I don't know what the judge would do. Professor Swain wasn't sure what a judge would do in the current scenario, but that's where we've left it. So I'll stop there, but I'll circle back and say I don't see that it's under our charter that we have a mandate to look at preemptive litigation, and as a practical matter, I don't know why any judge in any national court would care what ICANN said about that scenario. Our responsibility is to determine what happens to the underlying UDRP decision and is there a further process within the UDRP context if the judge grants immunity. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil. And I said it's Mary. Was actually at least inclined to agree with you in respect of ICANN's limited authority on pre-UDRP statutes and actions. And also, I think you're perfectly right. Bill, what we have seen here is that any party are free to take a case to a national court, and it's up to the court to decide if they can deal with the case or not. And that's the regulation we have today, both with the URS and the UDRP. So what we're trying to solve is if to find a way that if the court says no, we can't take the case, is there still a possibility to have the main holder to have the case decided finally in with all full details and discussions and so in an arbitration procedure. I see on the agenda that we also have the Phil, is that your hands up? Okay, thanks. I see that we have our on our agenda also the review of illustrative sampling of data, and although we have 10 minutes left today, I think it's I thank the staff for putting together that document. It's it was very interesting and very illustrative. But I think we leave that for today and have a further look on it, and then proceed to point four, ICANN 59 planning. So, Mary, do you have anything to say about our agenda there?
Hi, Petter and everyone. This is Mary from staff. So I guess that was actually our question for the working group, although it does seem from the tenor of the discussion today that one potentially major issue that we would take to the community in Johannesburg is the continuation of this discussion on option one versus option two, with specific focus on the arbitration question, what that might look like, and some of the points that Paul brought up that we've taken note of. Then the question would be, what else should be on the agenda, noting that we are also, you know, in a position where we can share with the community some of the conclusions that we've reached on other points, for example, on 6TER, the fact that there might be some changes to the preliminary recommendation. We don't, on the staff side, know where things stand on the discussion of the separate dispute resolution process, whether that be something like the UDRP or much more narrow and focused, like a URS type of thing. But off the top of our heads, we would think that if the group wishes to present for discussion some of its initial conclusions on 6TER and standing, conduct the continuation of the discussion on arbitration in option 1 and 2, and perhaps the separate DRP, that would probably make for a rather lively session that would potentially fill up the time we have allocated, which I believe is 90 minutes.
Thanks, Mary. I think I hope that we can also discuss what we are considering now, the amended version of option two to present there. Phil?
Yeah, just to chime in and in basic agreement with what Mary outline, but of course, you know, what we do is subject to the will of the working group. We're not having a meeting next week because staff will be already in traveling to Johannesburg. I'll be leaving one day later next Friday. But we have, it's just a 90-minute session, so relatively short. I think start by just a brief update to the community members who are not members of this working group but who may be in the room about where we stand in our deliberations, the fact that we're probably going to dial back the import of Article 6 tier filing from being a separate basis for standing to rather being evidence of common law trademark rights, responding to many of the comments we received. Hopefully, the chart prepared by Barry will be reformatted, and we can review that, which is, I think, useful for the likely universe of potential cases brought by that might be brought by IGOs. And then after sharing it well in advance with the working group and taking feedback before the meeting, discussion of what the elements of an option two arbitration might be, all the important elements as identified by Paul and others. So that would certainly easily fill 90 minutes. If there's other things that working group members believe we should address in Johannesburg, I think both co-chairs are open to that. But you know, I think that's probably the logical place to go next with our work. Thank
Thanks, Phil. Thanks, Phil Petter. I think it's yes. Of course, we need to give a summary and introduction, and I think we can do that fairly quickly to use our 90 minutes as efficient as possible, because it's also a good opportunity to maybe get some inputs also from other participants in Johannesburg. So I hope that we can have enough time for the topics that we discussed today, and had a possibility to move forward on this in Johannesburg. And Phil, your hands up. You want to say something more? No? Okay. Thanks. And although I see that we have 4 minutes left, I think that we are fairly clear with the topics of today. As said, we will send out hopefully before Johannesburg a new version of the second solution, so that we can study it and have a good base for further discussions in Johannesburg. And if I don't see any other topics or hands up, I think we can end the meeting for today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Darren, the operator, if you could stop all recordings. To everyone else, please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a lovely rest of your day.